I'm Caitlin Baggett Davis, and this is, by the way, Conversations with Portland. This is a new venture, and I'm so grateful to X-Ray FM for teaming up with me to make it possible. I'm going to start today with an overview of what this next hour of conversation will pursue and why. I've been thinking lately about what it means to build something for a city. Not a building or a bridge exactly, although I am interested in physical spaces, but what it means to build a culture or a civic identity. What it means to build and sustain a democracy, if we're going to be real about it. It requires a special mix of leaders, movements, and institutions. And we're using this conversation series to focus on the leaders who make Portland, Portland. I want to be clear from the outset, there is no intention here to expose information or break news, although our conversations will include people in positions of power in Portland. It's not fundamentally a project with a theory about power or interested in the mechanisms of power. I'm interested in people. I'm interested in the generosity, creativity, quirks, and shy hopes, the bold visions of people in our particular place in this particular moment who find themselves in positions from which they can serve the city and the region. Our conversation will move through three rough acts: a personal introduction, a lighthearted exploration of something in the local news that is really not my guest's job, and finally, my guest's current work and goals. My hope is that these conversations stray far from a resume, pitch, or stump speech, that we get to do rare and human things. Play, delve, go deeper, go the long way, and along the way, by the way, celebrate the complex humanity of the people we meet. In May, Juan Carlos Gonzalez was elected to serve as the president of the regional government, Metro. He was born in Forest Grove, raised in Cornelius, and now lives in Beaverton, meaning his whole life has unfolded inside the district he now serves. Juan Carlos made history in 2018, becoming the youngest member and first Latino to be elected to the Metro Council. His priorities for the council are creating more affordable housing and jobs in the region, and Metro has begun what it calls Future 50, a periodically mandated planning process designed to shape the metro area through 2077. Juan Carlos, your social media leads with new dad, proud Oregonian, son of immigrants. Would you be willing to share your parents' immigration story?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so good to be here with you, to have the opportunity to ruminate about this city and this place that I love, that you love, and hoping that we can make it shine to its best capacity. So as you noted, I am the son of two immigrants from Mexico. My mom is Alicia, and my dad is Francisco. My mom grew up in Mexico City. She grew up with a really big family there. And when she was a teenager, made the decision to come to the United States. My grandma had already made her way to Los Angeles, the LA area, to do some work. And my mom was very studious. She was very dedicated to academics and knew that she wanted to make more of her life than what was possible for her at that time in Mexico. And so she came after she completed high school and was immediately looking for higher education opportunities. And I always look at my mom as the driving force behind me and my siblings, really, really caring about our education. My dad, Francisco, he grew up in a really rural town in Michoacán. And his story is a little bit different because his family worked in the fields with cattle, with goats and cows and all that stuff. And he actually had to drop out of school like around the fifth or the sixth grade. So he never really had the opportunity for education. The funny thing is that he also immigrated when he was a teenager, and they met in Oregon, as a matter of fact, because their places that they grew up in were very, very separate from each other. They met in Cornelius, Oregon, which is where I grew up. And before I ran for office at Metro, I worked for a community-based organization, a Latino nonprofit called Centro Cultural, that has served Washington County for a little over 50 years now. And my parents, when they were teenagers, they met at Centro. The organization had a partnership with one of the churches there in Cornelius, and they had a youth choir program. And my parents kind of started getting to know each other, singing hymns with the local church in Centro Cultural. And that is my parents' immigration story at a very basic level. But I feel really lucky that they picked Oregon of all the places that they could have been in the country, in the world. And I feel just so lucky that this is my home and that now I am raising a kid here. It's wonderful.
Yeah, education was a really big part of this story, and singing, evidently. What did the conversation about education sound like in your family when you were growing up?
Yeah, well, my dad, for as long as I can remember, he has worked in manual labor. So he's been in landscaping and construction, Like right now, he's in his mid-50s, and he builds irrigation systems for new residential construction.
It's really hard work.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And when I was a kid, like me and my brother, who's 3 years younger than me, my dad had a small landscaping company, and that was the primary source of income for our family because my mom was going to school. She was trying to level up and get her master's in counseling because she wanted to, and she still works in education. So again, our family made a lot of sacrifices for that. But I remember that in the summers and the weekends, my brother and I, we would always work with my dad.
Yeah.
One, because it was kind of like childcare. Like, like we had to be with someone, so we were with him. And two, also because he needed help to make sure that we could do all the work that we needed to do. And my dad would always tell us, he's like, if you don't want to live like this, if you don't want to be cold and wet, if you don't want to be hot and thirsty, if you don't want to be exhausted when you get home, like you have to study and you have to work really hard in school. And I know that that motivated me a lot to do that. And my mom too. So she, to this day, she's worked at Portland Community College for, I think, almost 20 years now. And she works at Rock Creek Center out in Washington County in the in the Women's Resource Center. So she's working every single day with immigrants, single moms, women fleeing domestic violence to pursue their education, to get the skills they need to take care of their families. So education for us was always a tool to achieving the American dream, as corny as that is. But I just feel really grateful that my parents prioritized that for us. And I feel like that, to me, set me on a path that has absolutely shattered, I think, any expectations that I would have had for myself as a young Mexican-American kid growing up in Cornelius and Forest Grove area.
It's interesting. We were just talking about this. You know, I grew up, my father was a farmer, and my brothers and I started working on the farm when we were little, 8, 9, 10 years old. A little bit of childcare, but also the work needed to happen.
Yeah.
And I wake up every day still thinking, you got to pinch me. I get to put on cute clothes, talk to smart people about ideas and community. I'm not working with my body every day. I don't come home tired and dirty. That's a tension in my life. I imagine it is for you as well. There's an identity that you develop growing up doing labor, doing you know, what my family would call real work. I don't know that they think what I do is real work. Is that a tension in your life?
That is so interesting. I love that question. And I think that for a long time, working in the spaces that I was working in, they were pretty non-traditional, I think, to what immigrant parents think success is.
Yeah.
So like, you got to be a doctor, you got to be a lawyer, you got to be an architect. or an engineer, right? There's like the list of things that are defined as success. And I was like, no, I'm going to go work for a social services nonprofit. And I was actually then a fundraiser. So they're like, what are you doing? And then I ran for office and, you know, they're really proud of me, but also like, what is Metro, right? That is that is constantly the conversation that I'm having with people all over the place all the time. But I think one element of my journey that has made me truly appreciate the work that I can do now is a lot of the people that I grew up with and their parents lived very similar lives to what my dad and what my family lived in Cornelius. And it's you know, people always tell you, don't forget where you came from, don't forget your roots. And thankfully my parents still live in Cornelius. I'm there very regularly. It's always a reminder, like a very nostalgic, powerful reminder of that. And hopefully kind of keeps me and my entire team and the agency that I'm now leading grounded in the working lives of people and also the tremendous power and responsibility that we have to making people's lives better, to changing the conditions of opportunity. Because I feel very lucky. You know, I got a full ride to Georgetown. I got to study economics. I got to study government. I've gotten to do so many amazing things in my life. And I want to make sure that I'm not just the lucky one that managed to do it, but that more and more people that grew up here have the opportunity to have that same story. Something I feel really strongly about.
The metro region is 24 cities, three counties, spans, you know, from Forest Grove to Oregon City, Wilsonville, Beaverton. Yep. I'm getting the contours there. My guess is that when you were at Georgetown and you told people where you were from, they had a certain idea of what Portland is, what it means to be from Portland. And but you've spent your whole life in this region, maybe in ways that don't show up in that idea of Portland. Mm-hmm. What do people get wrong about this region, about where you're from?
Yeah, I mean, there's a collective consciousness for sure, I think, that the country has about us.
Yeah.
Some narratives that are old and tired, and some narratives that are new and definitely tired. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm absolutely tired of what some of the national media says about us and continues to say about us. And then also, I do think that one of the most challenging legacies that we have as a state and as a city, as a region, is our history through the lens of race and racial injustice.
Yeah.
From the point that our constitution was created and the limitations that implemented for people to own property, to be able to be Oregonians. And, you know, I think about history through the lens of chapters, through the lens of ideas and phases of our state's history. And I do see some through lines between the founding of our state and today and some of these ideas about Portland being the whitest city in America, about Oregon being a state that is mostly white. And, you know, I do think that when I leave or when I was in college, that was very much the reputation. I grew up in a city in Cornelius, west of Portland, that was 55% Latino. Mm-hmm. And even when I'm there and I'm walking around the block, like, I hear people talking in Spanish, I hear music in Spanish, I smell foods from all over Latin America. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very, very deeply global, integrated place. And I think that there are a lot of places like that in Portland, in the Portland area, that we probably have not invested in to the degree to solidify the kind of districts and the neighborhoods that give the appeal for destinations that then kind of make up our broader psyche. But I do think that there is so much happening in the region that is actively changing the face of what we are. I think that by the time that I'm done as Metro Council president in these next 8 years, I hope that one of my legacies is that we are no longer seen as the whitest city in America, that we're seen as a place of opportunity, a place that is safe, that is welcoming, that is green, a place where anything is possible for someone. I so deeply yearn for us to not just rebrand ourselves, but to recast our ambitions on a more global scale. And that is a really special role I think Metro has across all of the things that we do for this place. And that's what really motivates me.
Okay, I want to go back to college. Yeah. This is interesting stuff, and we're gonna begin unpacking it a little bit. But let's stay in Act One in your life. What was it like for you as a kid from Cornelius being at Georgetown?
Honestly, it was the biggest culture shock that I could have ever imagined.
In what way?
It was. I mean, well, DC in general is a fascinating city. It's a city with extraordinary power. It's also a city with extraordinary wealth that descends mm-hmm. into that place, the influence power. Mm-hmm. And for someone that had, you know, no money, and very little tools to be able to enjoy the city, and also the East Coast culture compared to a small suburb town, a more rural town was fascinating. I often felt shocked by the amount of wealth and influence that my classmates had, mm-hmm. the like private school upbringing, how so much of their life was manicured for them, and the amount of preparation, the amount of tools that they had. But one of the things that I've always taken from that experience that I'll never forget is like, yeah, do their families have more money than me? Sure. Did they have more preparation than me? Sure. But they're not going to work harder than me because they're not as hungry as I am.
There's a little pride in there.
Yeah. There's like this chip on the shoulder.
Yeah.
And in some ways, like you get to see like high society unfold there, and seeing that up close was one of the reasons that after that experience, I wanted to come back to Oregon to do work in my community, because I took a job in Cornelius right after I graduated. And I was like, I didn't want to go to Wall Street. I didn't want to go to Silicon Valley. I didn't want to stay in DC. I wanted to go be with real people.
Yeah.
And that's just what the universe called for me. Yeah.
That pride that I'm going to work harder, and the knowledge that you will, right? Not just the flex, but actually putting in the work.
Yeah.
How does that show up for you now?
How does that show up for me now? You mean my experience as a graduate, or like the experience that I had in that time?
Are you working harder than anybody for the metro region?
I definitely feel like I am motivated to work hard. And, you know, first of all, like even that question about hard work.
Yeah.
Like I've gone to work with my dad.
Yeah.
Like I know what hard work is. I know what like back-breaking work is. And for me, like I feel like I'm working so hard, but it's different. And I'm like, I'm having fun, and I'm also exercising different muscles. And I guess I never see it as hard work in that way.
Yeah.
But I do apply myself so diligently. I throw myself at problems. And I do think one of the most important things that elected leaders can do is communicate a clear vision, be in the trenches with the people that are working to make those things better, and to motivate folks. Like, especially at Metro, we have over 1,000 employees. And one of the things I've learned in my short career as a professional and as a leader is people want to be believed in.
Yeah.
You know, people want to have someone that really believes that they can make something important happen. And I think we all yearn for that. I know I yearn for that.
You know,
I know my family yearns for that. And I think that is how democracy is at its strongest, but also how you rally the troops to make great things happen. I'm just one person as the council president, but I have an army of people behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And what we all do together is what gets me very, 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 very motivated, excited.
Well, I'm excited to dig into that motivation after our second act. But it's time for us to pivot to our mid-program detour, Not My Circus.
Oof.
This is the part of the show where I'm going to ask a highly talented community leader to help solve a problem that is really not his job. My guest today is Juan Carlos Gonzalez, the newly elected president of the Metro Regional Government. Like most highly talented people, you were just talking about the army at your back. Your network is your secret weapon, so you can call in a friend to help. Do you have someone ready to take your call?
I think I do. I think I do have a friend. We were talking yesterday, and we're like, what's the question going to be? I don't know.
Well, we're going to find out after we call them.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to ask my team to bring my phone here. Yeah, that one. Thank you. Shout out to Ren, the lovely Metro intern staffing me today. All right, should I call them now?
You should call them.
All right, let's see if they answer. Come on. Yes, you answered. All right, I'm with Caitlin. Caitlin's about to ask us the question.
All right, who do we have on the phone here?
Hey, this is Sean Connors. Juan's long-term best friend.
Yeah.
Sean, welcome to, by the way, Conversations with Portlanders. You understand that the bit we're doing is asking the two of you a problem-solving question that's certainly not Juan Carlos's job. We'll see if it's yours.
Sean knows more about more things than I could ever hope for. So,
all right.
I don't know if that's true, but I'll take it.
Yeah.
Mount Hood. Do either of you ski or snowboard?
Yes.
Okay.
He actually taught me how to snowboard. This really? Is hilarious. Yeah.
Sean, what was teaching him how to snowboard like?
Did you bring yourself already?
No, I did not. I swear.
It was interesting. I think we both learned a lot about ourselves. Juan, but I think I had a very like, you know, trial and error mentality, and it was a great powder day. It was probably a foot of fresh powder on the ground, which is really hard to manage when you're just getting into snowboarding. And Juan, on the first run, I think, you know, fell and got up and fell several times. By like the third run, we were cruising and having a blast. But there was a point there where I was worried for our relationship.
it can be hard. He took me down a black diamond when I was just starting. It was like fresh powder.
I think it was a blue.
All right, cool. It was
he,
a blue.
He had faith in you.
You know, when I tell the story to myself, I tell it's a much more badass story when I
replay it in my mind. Yeah. It was a black diamond.
Yeah. Thanks, bro.
All right, here we go. Low snowpack is forcing mountain resorts to end their seasons weeks ahead of schedule, as you know, with some areas shutting down daytime operations in the winters.
Okay.
Crews are bringing dump trucks full of snow just to keep main runs open. I know this isn't your job, but how would you go about leading adaptation for Mount Hood?
Ooh, that's a good question. How would we adapt Mount Hood?
From a ski resort?
Yeah, or snowpack or something like that.
Or like, what do you think it should be instead?
Or what should it be instead? I mean, that's a great question. Well, I know Sean grew up on the East Coast as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gone to see different kind of like lower summit mountains manage their slopes differently. I would certainly hope that going forward, Mount Hood continues to have great snow because I want to keep snowboarding and I want to teach my daughter how to snowboard there. But what do you think, Sean?
I mean, I think, you know, I grew up with a lot of snow machines on mountains, which is a huge water waster and hard to envision as a long-term solution by any means. I mean, I think I love being up there in the summer. I think the bike park and downhill and mountain biking options are phenomenal. I think utilizing just more hiking and summer activities and just blending them more into the resort would be a good solution. But I guess it kind of depends if you're the owner of the resort or if you're just an Oregon resident who wants to make sure that it's, you know, a place to go all year round. Kind of depends.
So I'm hearing Juan Carlos is in denial. And Sean has some like worst case scenario options. Is this typical of your friendship?
Yeah, I mean, Sean is the problem solver. Like he'll just go and be like, "We know what, we can fix it. We can build it." And I'm like, "How, man? We got to set up a committee. We got to evaluate all the solutions." No, I'm kidding.
Are you kidding?
There's been a couple funny phone calls where I call Juan and Lorena, his wife's in the car, and really, you know, we say hi quickly and then we just go through like three or four bullet points that we had to talk about and then just hang up, and Lorena finds that very funny.
We had to go through our business.
It's efficient.
Okay, dream big. Hi. What should Mount Hood be 50 years from now when there is no snow?
Wow. When there is no snow, I hope that we can use it as a place to study the natural habitat, a place of science, a place of recreation, and a place that continues to remind us of the like the biodynamics of this specific Cascadia region that we live in, and hopefully helps future generations have a stronger relationship of stewardship and protecting and owning the environment in the way that we need to. So I'm hoping that we still have snow in 50 years, but you know, I guess we have to prepare for every scenario.
So not the nation's largest slip and slide park.
You know, that's you know, I've seen some videos of like the little like what is the they have like little rail trains that you can kind of go down. It's kind of like touristy. I mean I don't want to encourage like tourist traps, but I do want to make sure people get outside and connect with nature. Yeah. So it's like it's a balance.
Well, Sean, you've been a really good sport.
Great answer.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for joining us, Sean.
All right, man. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Well, that was fun.
Thanks for going on the little detour. Are you ready for Act Three?
Yeah, I'm ready for Act Three.
All right, we're going to dig in. So you're a fan of Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson's book, Abundance.
I am.
Everybody knows. Klein and Thompson argue that our scarcities, housing, infrastructure, energy, are all politically and institutional, they're political and institutional choices, not technological or inevitable outcomes. When you consider the metro region that your daughter's growing up in,
yeah,
what is scarce now that should be abundant?
I love this question so much. I mean, the abundance framework is something that I've been tracking way long before Derek Thompson and Ezra Klein wrote this book, right?
Oh,
this
yeah.
This school of thought that is just full of opportunities for governance. And what inspires me is this like commitment to institutional renewal, the concept of state capacity, and these ideas that we can make things better and that we do not need to accept these institutions or these policies or these frameworks that are a little calcified and a little slow and are not helping us to meet the crises of the day. That really resonates with me. And I bring that energy with Metro into the team at Metro. I think what is incredibly scarce, and no one's going to be surprised about this, is housing.
What?
It's what? Whoa, what? Where did that come from? And I do think that here in Oregon in particular, we have a really complicated relationship with growth. And I talked earlier about the founding of our state and our constitution. And I actually feel like there's a direct through line between that and today. And I talk a lot about the legacy of Tom McCall, Governor Tom McCall. And I feel like he's a figure.
He said, please visit.
Visit, but don't stay.
But don't stay.
Those words have always touched me so deeply. And he did great work, right? The bottle bill and the public beaches and our state's land use system, which is one of Metro's most important responsibilities in managing for the greater Portland area. But when I think about the question, visit but don't stay, was my family supposed to visit or were we supposed to stay? And that to me has always sparked the question, who is Oregon for? The constitutional framework, you know, forefathers or those folks, they had a vision about who Oregon was for. It was very limited. And my concern is our relationship with growth, with limiting our local governing authorities from building the things that we need to continue to feed into this question of, can Oregon actually be the place that is welcoming for people and that people that want to be here can be here, that they can afford to live here, that they have a right to live here? I think those are the things that I'm actively trying to manage. And we have policy and the things that we say, and then we have the mechanisms which are just getting in the way, I think, of doing that. And I'm not saying that we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but we absolutely need to look at ourselves in the mirror and ask ourselves, what are the tools that we need to build housing? And so anyway, I think about that a lot. It's very deep to me.
Now, one of the central arguments that Ezra Klein has certainly made over the last couple of years is that many of the mechanisms that are in place to slow or stop growth are put in place to protect communities, and particularly vulnerable communities, communities of color, especially Black communities, and that it seems that some of the way that those tools have been used has actually caused deeper harm in those communities, but that tension still exists. How do you think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the communities that I represented in my former seat, District 4, and again, I'll keep going back to the city that I grew up in, there, over the last few decades, there are these common themes that also pop up where you're constantly engaged. What's the problem? What's the problem? And the community gives the solution, and then nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And then 5 years later, there's a new administration, and they're like, I want to go engage you. Tell me what the problem is. Tell me what the problem is. And they're like, the rent's too high. The buses don't show up on time. Our parks, we need more parks. And people have always had these priorities. So I think about what I feel like are universal priorities and going out to get them and going out to deliver things for people. I think about that general nature. Specific to what the authors of the book say regarding that, I think what's important to me is strong engagement, and we need to have really comprehensive engagement. But then there needs to be a point where we act and where we're able to decide and move forward. Sometimes I feel like in Portland, we instead of getting to yes faster, we get to no slower, and it's just this. We love to create process and process and process. And that's really frustrating to me, especially as a millennial who wants to be a part of a dynamic environment of change and making things happen. And it's very important to me that we kind of get our economic engine going again, make sure that we're building things again. I want to see cranes in the sky, et cetera. But I do think that there's a way to set up processes in a way that are informed by racial justice, that are informed by inclusivity and equity in a way that we're able to better equip the government to go and deliver things. And at the same time, recognize that, you know, any action at any point creates trade-offs. Yeah. What we need is the courage and the bravery to present those trade-offs, manage them, mitigate the burdens. But what I also don't want to do is let the fear of creating trade-offs completely paralyze action. Mm-hmm. And I think what people are really frustrated about right now, this is my own kind of interpretation of the world, is frustration with inaction.
Yeah.
Like people that have been in power or institutions that have been in power, and it's like, why aren't things better? Mm-hmm. And those are really good questions, that we should all be asking ourselves, which is why I come back to institutional renewal, state capacity. We cannot just assume that the status quo is going to help us going forward.
Okay, I got to dig in on this.
Yes, please. We're passionate.
What is institutional renewal? What institution? How is it getting renewed? And what is state capacity?
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate you asking me about that. Institutional renewal to me is kind of a framework that I'm applying in my leadership as the Metro Council president. And it's something that with our leadership, I'm constantly asking my team, what is the value that we're bringing to people? And is this the value that they need right now?
Yeah.
Do we have a 40-year-old program that is maybe doing some good, or could we be doing something that is much more relevant or pressing to people? The best example that I could give you is because of our current economic conditions, some of our departments have been really kind of struggling just with finances and costs and revenue. We performed a zero-based budgeting approach, which takes a pretty radically different lens at how you build a budget and a department. Traditional government budgeting is like, what did you do last year? And then put a cost of living increase to that.
Yeah.
Whereas a zero-based budget is you actually start from the ground up and say, what do you need right now to maximize the programs that we're committed to doing, delivering to the community? And that actually saved us a few million dollars that we're now redirecting to new priority areas. And I feel, again, really motivated and excited about that.
Institutional renewal is like a snake shedding its skin.
Yeah, it's just like we shouldn't be afraid to ask ourselves, how can we be better?
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like people are afraid to ask themselves that question because it assumes that we've been lazy or you know, wasteful.
Yeah.
And it, I think that's the wrong framing mm-hmm. to take mm-hmm. because we shouldn't want to just preserve what we have for the sake of it.
Yeah.
We should want to make it make the most positive impact that it can make. And I see myself as a new generation mm-hmm. of elected official, as a new generation leader that has this responsibility to say, hey, we have some of these institutions that, you know, and a lot of, I think Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson do a good job talking about this. A lot of the agencies and a lot of the landmark policies that drive the way the world works today are, mm-hmm. you know, they happened after the New Deal, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. It was a part of a very expansionist period of policy making and strong central governance. Mm-hmm. And there was an incredible project that the country took on at that point. I think that right now we're at the point where we can actually embark on a new kind of similar scale of project. And our generation has the luxury, the opportunity to design something, I think, for the first time in a very long time. And you see this in, you know, races across the country where the incumbency and the status quo, and you have kind of new ideas emerging. I think it's really exciting.
I'm going to go back to scarcity for a second, but you were getting all optimistic. Yeah, I appreciate it.
I'm an optimist. We're going to have snow, right? We're going to have snow.
Okay.
We're going to build housing.
Well, let's talk about jobs.
Yeah.
The thing that feels, that looks especially scarce to me in our region right now is
that's true.
Great living wage jobs mm-hmm. and employers who want to build their legacy here in partnership with community. Yeah. You've been talking about Metro having a role in that. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? How do you work with the city or the 24 cities to develop a regional view for employment?
Well, at first, I just really appreciate you saying that. Because sometimes it feels like jobs or business can feel like a four-letter word, like something that we should run away from.
I'm a working class person. You know what working class people want?
Jobs. That's my line. Let's go. All right, cool. I'm gonna try to keep using that one. I love this question. I think it's so important. It comes back to what I think is our relationship with growth as well, and I do think that a strong city, a strong region, you need a strong employer base, you need a strong sense of jobs, you need to make sure that Oregonians and the people that live here are prospering and that they're doing better. And my concern right now is that we're trending in the wrong direction because we're shedding thousands of jobs. And the worst part is, the scary part is that, you know, you see data and forecasts that it can actually get worse if we don't intervene. I see Metro has a responsibility to take on a greater role in our economic development. Primarily, I think for decades, Metro took this approach of managing growth.
Yeah.
I mean, for such a long time, growth just fell on our lap. We had people that wanted to be here, jobs that wanted to be here. I mean, it was, you know, was a really special time. And for the first time in modern memory, we have little growth. Mm-hmm. We don't have as many people knocking on the door. We don't have as many, jobs knocking on the door. And I think that means our region needs to build a new muscle. So my line and what I'm sharing with folks is, you know, for generations, Metro's managed growth, but what do you do when there's little growth to manage? So I think, again, we have this responsibility to do that. We're convening across the regional scale to create economic development strategy. We're taking some big bets on what some of the studies have shown around what we really lack. Because we were so successful for a short amount of time, we took for granted some of the tools that we needed mm-hmm. that all of our other competitor regions now have, and they're implementing like them way beyond any level of capacity.
Can you get specific about what do you mean by tools?
Yeah, so the tools that I see across departments of commerce or departments of economic development, they have really strong alignment from the state to their regional to their city level. Right now, our tools are very fragmented. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating. You have the states that are kicking our butts right now have a more of a white glove customer service. So, for example, let's say that you are an employer, you're someone that wants to make something happen. You're basically assigned like a project manager that then goes to all the bureaus and helps you manage all your permits. Here, I mean, you knock on a door at the state, you have like 50 doors that you need to look through the, and then it's like good luck figuring out stuff at the local level
like
as well.
Like a growth concierge.
Yeah, it's kind of like a concierge, exactly. And, you know, I don't think that Oregon will ever be or wants to be like a Texas or an Arizona, because they implement a very different values framework. But I do think that Oregonians want to see specific kinds of, we want to see high paying jobs. We want to see clean jobs. Yeah. We want to see jobs that are pushing innovation and technology in a way that can improve quality of life of the planet. And the truth is, a lot of those investments and innovations are happening outside of here.
Yeah.
So I think we have to ask ourselves what we want and then create the tools for that. Another really important thing that Metro has the opportunity to lead on is what we call a job ready lands program. We have not for a long time created the tools that our state needs to activate our infrastructure to make our land ready. And this, again, comes back to what I think is a cultural barrier, a cultural challenge that we have, that I think we do not want to invest in tools for infrastructure, because that means that we will then grow. And if we grow, then that means that there's more people. And if there's more people, then there's more traffic. So I think people view growth as a con, as a negative. And what I want to help figure out for our generation of Oregonians is making sure that people feel like growth happens for them rather than to them. It's a very challenging thing.
Well, and in the world of economic growth, we use growth in two ways. One is population growth and the other is economic growth. And we often assume that the two are the same thing, right? And population growth is often identified as a tool to support economic growth. But there are places that have economic growth without population growth.
That's so insightful.
And so I think it's a little more complicated than some of the conversations I'm currently hearing make it out to be.
Yeah, I agree.
And then there's this other half of the coin of, look, over the next 50 years, 100 million people globally are going to need a new place to call home. Do we have a responsibility to create a climate oasis for human life in one of the top 10 places on the globe where humans can live after climate change?
Do we have the political courage to actually welcome those people?
Yeah.
I right now, in this current framework, I think we have a lot of really well-aligned, well-intentioned policies and regulatory frameworks that are actually preventing us from doing that. And I think we need to find ways to communicate that, to create the opportunity for people to understand, actually be really affirmative in doing that. And when I see the level of affordability in our region right now, the level of homelessness that we have, I mean, we're very much, I think, living the consequences of decades of inaction. And what I think is, like, we have the chicken coming home to roost in terms of this, the relationship that we've had with building our built environment, with supporting growth, with wanting to be a place that is more than just welcoming on paper and with our words, but with our actions and our policy.
There's one more theme I want to explore, and then we probably should start wrapping ourselves up here. But Metro's tagline could basically be, "We're all in this together."
I love that. We might have to steal that.
But
borrow it, copy it.
But belonging isn't a policy. It's a feeling. And I'm curious about your sense of regional belonging. When we talk about these big optimistic visions of welcoming people from around the globe to call our region home, does everybody in our region feel that we have a culture of belonging here? How do we build, and if not, how do we build that strength?
Well, when you were opening, you were talking about one of the big projects Metro is working on, the Future Vision Project, the Future 50 Project, which I really encourage listeners to go learn more about that. They can learn more about that by going to OregonMetro.gov/ Future 50, 50. And as a part of this project, we've assembled a commission of 24 people from the Portland metro area, representing every corner of this place. And the goal of this commission is to create a vision framework and document that mm-hmm. then informs many of the policies that underpin our infrastructure, our housing plans, our transit plans, our infrastructure plans for the entire Portland metropolitan area. And we recently completed a values survey. We've heard from over 10,000 people. And the top three things that they said that they valued up there was a welcoming nature and a safe nature of this region.
Hmm.
And when you ask them, what do they want in 50 years? If they want this place to be green, they want it to be safe, and they want it to be welcoming. People want to be able to belong here. And I think that, to me, signals that as a psyche, what connects us is we truly do value that.
Yeah.
And so if we do value that, how do we implement that to its highest degree possible? That is where I think, as elected officials, with governments like Metro, where our superpower is setting tables,
yeah.
where jurisdictions from all over can come together and create shared priorities, shared goals, is how we make the most and rebuild trust and confidence with voters for us to do big things.
All right, Juan Carlos Gonzalez is my guest today, and we're ending with our final question. I'm going to set it up for us. Since time immemorial, people in this place have stewarded the land we call home for future generations. 130 years ago, visionary civic leaders saw great promise for this town of about 17,500 people on the banks of the Willamette. They preserved land and a lake that now provide fresh drinking water to nearly a million people. Mm. That is called the Bull Run Reservoir. My question for you is, what is your Bull Run? What is something big or small that you believe we can build today for future generations?
This is such a beautiful question. This is the most Metro-coded question I've gotten in a long time. So kudos to you. A few weeks ago, my family and I, we were in Barcelona. And we went to the Sagrada Familia Basilica, just a tremendous achievement, like as a human species,
yeah.
of architecture, of vision, of and I was as I was sitting in that place, all I could ask myself was, what are the cathedrals that we're building in Portland?
Mm-hmm.
What are the cathedrals that will define our skyline, that will make people proud for generations? And I think that one of our cathedrals that we are actively working on right now is reconnecting the city to the Willamette River.
Mm.
And Metro has invested tens of millions of dollars in transformative visions. We've invested in the Willamette Falls Project in Oregon City, in the OMSI District, in the Albina Vision Trust, in Willamette Cove, and all up and down the Willamette River, reconnecting Oregonians and people in our urban and our built form to the river, I think, is one of our generation's cathedrals.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that we can make a lot of progress. And I think people are really excited about what's possible for this beautiful city and how we make it shine again, and how we show the world that we're capable of doing things that they wish that they could do.
Juan Carlos Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate having you on the program and
yes.
starting what I think is going to be a really exciting conversation for the region.
Thank you. Yes, it's a week three of me being the Metro president. So it's thank you for having me. And hopefully next time I'm back, we have so many things to celebrate and to build on.
All right. Thank you so much.